Tired of blogs?
Me too. Moby Lives Radio starts now. Intergalactic headquarters of Melville House Publishing in Hoboken, New Jersey, aka the Left Bank of New York City, it's Moby Lives Radio.
It's Monday, the 7th of November, 2005. I'm Dennis Johnson, and here's some news. Well, the weekend gave everyone in the book business time to think about Friday's blockbuster announcements from Amazon, Random House, and Google regarding their impending attempts to do to the publishing industry what Apple did to the music industry, which is kill the long concept format. Just like when Apple convinced people not to buy albums, but rather to buy individual songs, the idea of the moment in the book business seems to be that instead of selling books, you can sell individual pages. As Ed Wyatt announced in a New York Times article about Amazon and Google's development of software to do just that, it, quote, could revolutionize the way people read books. Random House promptly announced it would charge 4 cents a page for any such program, and the Authors Guild announced it was a positive development, said Paul Aiken, the executive director of the Authors Guild to the New York Times. This is the way it's supposed to work. To give consumers access to books and have revenues flow back to publishers and authors. Later in the day, PW Daily reported that, quote, reaction to yesterday's announcements from Random House and Amazon about pay-per-view schemes met with generally positive comments from industry players. What Amazon actually announced was that its program would be called Amazon Pages and that it would begin next year. It also announced another program called Amazon Upgrade, which will allow consumers to buy both the book and electronic version of the book at the same time. Google wasn't ready to announce anything except that it was keeping up with Amazon and it would soon announce its own similar program. All the excitement seems to be over the possibility of people cherry-picking favorite parts of books, such as recipes, single recipes, or poems, or short stories, say, from anthologies, or outtakes for research. What wasn't announced was what would happen to the complete work of art known as the novel, for example, nor were there any announcements, let alone any mention in our leading news journals, as to the impact of all this on those consumers known as readers. Such as how this will probably mean that books will now become significantly more expensive for them, especially if they take on the business of production, that is, having to print out and somehow bind those singly bought pages that they don't necessarily want to read on a computer screen. Or maybe that's what Ed Wyatt was talking about when he reported this is going to revolutionize the way you read. Well, elsewhere in the news, the other big announcement last week was the announcement from Simon & Schuster that its editor-in-chief, Michael Korda, was retiring. Korda had been at Simon & Schuster since 1958 when he came on board as an editorial assistant. He was made editor-in-chief 10 years later. He went on to edit everybody from Ronald Reagan to Mary Higgins Clark to David McCullough and even Jacqueline Suzanne. That's right, he was the editor of Valley of the Dolls. No word on what Court is doing next. My bet, he'll become an agent. Moving on in the news, here's a headline from Reuters reporting out of London yesterday. Fans, including Madonna, flock to Potter premiere. And I think that's all you need to know about that one. Another story concerns Harlequin, the publisher of romance novels, teaming up with the NASCAR stock car racing circuit. That's right. A licensing agreement between the two has been announced, wherein Harlequin will publish a variety of NASCAR-branded women's fiction titles. In a joint statement, the companies announced, quote, the novels by some of Harlequin's best-selling authors will have plot lines centering on NASCAR and will bear the NASCAR brand on their covers. NASCAR, meanwhile, claims 75 million fans and says 30 million of them are women. Finally today, some good news out of New Orleans, finally. The New Orleans Public Library has reopened. It's got limited hours. It's got limited services. But it is reopened. People can go in and use the internet. They can use the copiers and the fax machines. The library has waived all overdue fines. The unfortunate part of the story is that in order to get back up and running, the library had to lay off 90% of its workforce. And that's the news for today, Monday, the 7th of November, 2005. It's the 7th of November, and on this day in literary history, the great French writer Albert Camus was born in 1913. He was born in Algiers to a working-class family and moved to France when he was 25. During World War II, he joined the French Resistance and was editor and reporter for the legendary resistance newspaper Combat. During that time, he also wrote his legendary essay, The Myth of Sisyphus. And he went on after the war to continue writing political and philosophical journalism. He also went on to write some truly great books, such as The Rebel, The Stranger, The Plague, and others. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1957, and in 1960, while hitchhiking back to Paris from the French countryside, he accepted a ride and was subsequently killed in a car wreck. Albert Camus was 46 years old. I know my chicken. You got to know you're a chicken. I know my chicken. You got to know you're a chicken. I know my chicken. You got to know you're a chicken. I know my chicken. For years, David Kippen has been one of the most popular critics in the book business. First as editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and subsequently as just a critic and columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. But David Kippen is no longer a columnist, critic, or editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. In late July, while his name was being bandied about as one of the potential new editors of the Los Angeles Times book review section, it was suddenly announced that David Kippen was the new director of the literature program at the National Endowment for the Arts. I called him at his new office in the old post office building in Washington to see what in the world had happened.
David Kippen, after about a 15-year career as a journalist for places like the LA Daily News and Variety and Buzz Magazine and culminating as a columnist and an editor at one of the country's premier daily newspaper book sections, the San Francisco Chronicles, you have thrown it all away to become a G-man.
Yes.
You are now the director of literature at the NEA.
I am indeed. Pardon me while I adjust my shoulder holster. Keep a copy of Gravity's Rainbow in my armpit at all times.
Well, aside from the attraction of being able to carry a gun now, as opposed to killing people in print, what happened?
What happened was I'd been doing it. I'd been reviewing one and sometimes even two books a week for 5 years running, at least. And I got a call from a very persuasive guy named Dana Gioia, who's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts and a California native like myself. And I figured if he could stand Washington for a while, I could too. And also, it seemed like an opportunity to, you know, rather than jumping on poor innocent writers with hobnailed boots like I used to be paid to do, it seemed like an opportunity to, if you'll pardon me for getting a little grandiose for a moment, maybe do a little good. I mean, in addition to sort of grant-making process, which has traditionally been the job of the literature director, I'm going to be superintending this thing called the Big Read, which is going to try and get Americans reading again. I mean, you saw that study that came out last year from the NEA called Reading at Risk about how nobody's reading for fun anymore.
It was a bleak picture.
It was a bleak picture. Well, we're going to try and tag that bleak picture with some spray paint and maybe draw a little mustache onto all that bad news. We'll see.
Well, I think in addition to your reputation as a critic, you're also seen as a great champion. You wrote columns and had editing stints as well as just reviewing books. But what was it, do you think, or do you know, that made Dana Gioia come to you for this job? In other words, what are your qualifications for this, pal?
Well, your listeners will have no inkling of this, but it's been rumored in some quarters that I may be blessed with the gift of gab. and this, believe me, comes in handy in this line of work. And if you've ever heard the chairman expatiate behind a podium, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a large part of the job. I mean, come next year, I gather I'm going to be evangelizing around the country in these cities that will be doing One City, One Book programs, ideally a little more viably than a lot of cities with the exceptions certainly of Seattle and Chicago have done in the past. I'm going to be out there barnstorming, and I think part of that obliges me to not quail from an open microphone.
So the NEA is going to be more involved in the individual cities' campaigns to do book, one city?
The idea is to sort of provide a city read kit, basically. While some cities have done it very well, my own hometown of Los Angeles was reduced a couple of years ago to the indignity of, convening half a dozen people in a Pete's coffee shop and trying to get them talking about Fahrenheit 451. And it was kind of a sorry spectacle. So what we're going to do is, and this consumes a large part of my job, is writing and editing reading guides for a lot of really good books. We're starting with The Great Gatsby and To Kill a Mockingbird and Fahrenheit 451 and Their Eyes Were Watching God. And there will be a book added each month after that until at some indeterminate point in the future there will be an entire backlist, a catalog, where a city can contact the NEA, I think apply for a grant, and receive in return reading guides by the thousands, CDs with interviews with Arbiter's Elegantarium, divagating on the merits of the book at hand, radio shows for broadcast in these markets, interstitial television spots, basically a reading guide, a one city, one book undertaking in a box, and maybe even a little cash on the side. So we mean to get America reading again, and this is the best idea we've had so far. Though we're open to further suggestion, of course.
Well, these are celebratory times for the NEA, as I recall. Is it next year that is the 40th anniversary?
On the contrary, it is this very year that
this
is
year.
The 40th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson signing into law the act that created both the National Endowment of the Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. I hear that so many times I've started saying it myself. The National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, which happens to be my neighbor downstairs in the old post office building where the NEA is located.
Mm-hmm.
Notice we're on a higher floor.
And of course, as it should be.
Yeah, and our systems department is even higher than I am.
Well, we see the government ranking system.
We do, don't we?
But what's going on for the 40th? I mean, are there specific events?
Well, we have new letterhead. And yeah, I gather there's a there's an enormous splashy celebration and symposium in Austin, Texas in a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working it into conversation every chance I get.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think that the Big Read is going to embody a lot of the things that the NEA has come to stand for in 40 turbulent, but I would think, on the whole, fairly successful years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been on the job for close to a month now?
Over a month? I wish that were the case, but in fact, I started on September the 6th, so it's already 7 weeks, and still I go downstairs to the to the mall and I see people who aren't reading. I mean, of course, I thwack them with my handy ruler, but even so, we haven't achieved 100% penetration in almost 2 months.
Besides from that colossal failure, what's been the most difficult part of the job? This is quite a transition.
Well, yes. I mean, I do miss California. I was rather incessantly a champion of things Western in my previous position, and I haven't renounced my affiliation as a Californiac. And as it starts raining and maybe in a month or two snowing, I think the nostalgia may become even more pronounced. But I don't know. I mean, I guess I miss bylines a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. At the risk of embarrassing and or annoying some people here in my office, I was thinking about this morning. The great compensating thing has been something that I've never really been able to do before. And that's, in a way, to teach. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got all these bushy-tailed people around me, really smart people, some of them fresh out of school. And they're working with me on these reading guides.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they, you know, need a little seasoning, but they're all really enthusiastic. And
mm-hmm.
it's just sort of invigorating to be around that and maybe try to, you know, channel it into more productive sentence structures. And so, yeah, I mean, if I had more time, I'd miss California even more. But luckily, it's kind of, you know, the best 5 jobs I've ever had, and doesn't leave a whole lot of time for nostalgia left over.
Well, you did mention missing bylines. What are you going to do with that writing muscle?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm straitjacketed somewhat, and I'm sure for the best of reasons, by the legal department here, which you know wants me to be careful about what I say, because everything I say tends to carry the weight of the NEA behind it. So I can't very well go slamming some writer in print who might turn around and either apply for a grant
mm-hmm.
or get turned down for a grant and think we've got it in for him. I mean, basically, you know, the nature of my job at the Chronicle was having everybody think I had a vendetta against them, when
mm-hmm.
in fact, you know, I would have been grateful for the time to nurse a decent grudge, but it just wasn't there. That's also an occupational hazard around here, and I kind of have to be really careful not to cultivate people's paranoia that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think, though, that there will be opportunities to write about, as the chairman suggested, dead people, because dead people make no grant applications. You know, if we want to do an appreciation of somebody either just gone or maybe 100 years gone. And I had an idea for an essay that I don't think would step on too many toes. I think have you been following the Sudoku phenomenon?
The Sudoku, no.
Yes, these are these number puzzles that are proliferating in newspapers around the country.
Yes.
I'd love to write a piece about how Sudoku is crossword puzzles for illiterates. Because, I mean, I think, you know, if I'm going to be championing reading here, the point needs to be made that, you know, every advance for the world of numbers is a retrenchment for the world of letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to go on the offensive.
Well, As a winner of the NEA myself,
I beg your pardon.
I won an NEA grant years ago.
Damn it.
As a young writer,
mm-hmm.
who I think I should be the poster boy for the NEA grant program to write.
How much did you win, and what did you do with it?
I won $20,000.
Good God!
Which was the standard grant award at the time.
Still is.
And it was at the time that the program was endangered because the branch of the awards, but the visual arts had
right.
there'd been all kinds of controversies,
mm-hmm.
and but I was quite proud to win the award because or proud to speak on behalf of winning the award because it did exactly what it is supposed to do in my instance. I was starving and broke and in great debt, and it allowed me to keep writing, and I've always felt kind of a warm spot to the NEA as a result, because it didn't indeed come at the point where I was probably going to have to quit soon and get a real job, and instead it allowed me to keep my surreal job. And I've always wondered if at the NEA you hear from people like me, if people that have won the award in the past want to stay in the system somehow to kind of spread the goodwill, or what the NEA does to to foster that.
I'm very glad you brought this up. For one thing, because it reminds me of something else we're doing for our 40th anniversary, which is creating a book that brings together all the names, including presumably yours, if you're not, you know, lying on your resume here, who have ever won an NEA grant, and testimonials from some of them about what it did for them. We published something similar, I don't know, 5-10 years ago under the Jane Alexander administration,
mm-hmm.
and it's a lovely book to page to. It's this wonderful essay by Jane Smiley
mm-hmm.
talking about how the money was nice, but what meant so much more to her was the strange fact of her country saying thank you, what you do has value.
Exactly.
I mean, it's sort of heartwarming to read, and so I'd be very curious to go back and look up, you know, the year you won, who won in that same class.
Well, I won in 1894.
I figured, yeah.
And one of my striking memories is getting a letter from my senator,
uh-huh.
Alphonse D'Amato.
Oh, God!
Who was a man I had actively campaigned against. He was known as Senator Pothole in New York City.
Right.
And yet I got a personal note from him, and I remember being very touched
mm-hmm.
and thinking that someone I had drastic disagreements with
yeah.
had stooped so low as to send a note of congratulations and to thank me for the way I was representing New York State as an artist, and it was it was a good moment in many ways.
It would be interesting to go back and see how Senator D'Amato voted in some of the during some of the controversy, whether he wanted to continue funding the NEA or cut us off.
Well, I honestly don't recall, but I do recall that it seemed a close call.
You saved the NEA. You swayed the swing vote.
That's probably the way it worked out. I have little doubt of that. I did actually meet D'Amato at one point, and he had no memory of me at all. But
I say tomato, by the way.
You're too fast for this hour of the day, David. Let's go back to that for a moment, though. You're recalling the moment when the NEA did seem to be in trouble.
Yeah.
And it has persevered.
It has indeed, and the chairman actually has a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
This past year, for the first time in donkey's years, our allocation actually went up instead of down.
Mm-hmm.
So we're feeling a little
frisky.
Let's
repeat that. Here in the Bush administration, which many would think is anti-art,
mm-hmm.
You're saying that the budget actually was increased.
Absolutely it was.
Well, you heard it here first, folks.
Actually, you heard it in I don't know how many press releases,
right.
but you heard it here, folks. You heard it here first, Dennis.
Well, so is there anything lingering from that time? I think actually that a lot of people still make a strong association between the NEA and that controversy. And,
they do.
And is the controversy dead, or what do you see of it from inside?
Oh, there's probably still a couple of people on Capitol Hill who think the country would be better off without us. But
mm-hmm.
on the whole, I think our position is pretty secure. Now what we have to do is give people something to associate us with besides a 10-year-old dead controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, apparently there was a feeling around here for years ago that our job was to stay out of the newspapers.
Right.
And that's slowly, under the chairman's leadership, being replaced by the feeling that we have to get into the newspapers just for the good stuff we do.
Right.
And so, you know, I gradually see that happening.
That's it for Moby Liz Radio today. We'll be back tomorrow with reports from Jessa Crispin in Chicago. And Susan Ramsey, bookseller in Michigan, will give us the latest news from Kalamazoo. We had help today from Andrew Steinmetz, Kelly Burdick, Becky Kramer, and Valerie Marians. We'll be back tomorrow. We hope you will too. In the meantime, remember, that whale is out there, man.
That limousine in which you made the scene suits you to a T. If all that you want to be is somebody that don't ever walk nothing, that big chateau where you want to go in the south of France, gonna end a big romance. Don't you do it. Honey, don't rebel, eh? That Riviera's so far away, making you see play, baby. They don't know nothing down in Saint-Tropez, but I
to leave LA. I heard it said that you had it made with your moving star.